This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Albert Camp. Today is July 14, 2011. We are in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech. Okay, Albert, why don't we begin, if we could, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
Well, I was born in Niagara Falls. Although I consider myself a southerner, Georgia particularly, but my father was career Army.
Okay.
And that's where he was stationed. He was stationed at Fort Niagara when I was born. I've never been back. I left there at 6 months of age and came south, to be honest with you. I was born in 1940. So basically up through 45, we were military,
okay.
But I was so young I don't remember very much of that. I do know that, for example, Daddy was never sent overseas. He was always in a training command.
Oh, okay.
And we basically shuttled between Texas and Fort Benning in Georgia.
Okay.
He retired right after the war ended, and they did try to settle in Columbus, Georgia, because they had loved Benning. It was one of their favorite stations. But they found out fairly quickly that being in the Army and being retired were two entirely different things.
Mm.
And so the social life, the friends they had, that type of thing, it was really sort of a divide being retired, and they decided very shortly to go back to their little hometown called Bartow, Georgia, which I have always considered home, and build a house and retire there. And that's what they did.
Okay.
So from the time I was basically 8 years old, Bartow was home.
Okay.
And no matter where I've lived, if you ask where home was, it was Georgia. That's just me.
Sure.
I don't understand people today who don't have roots of that nature. You know, my family's been there 200 years. And I grew up in rural Georgia, basically. When it came time to go to college, I spent 1 year at a little North Georgia junior college called Young Harris, but in a way I really did not expect. I expected to spend 2 years there. I loved it. And again, I think it was the smallness that appealed to me. You weren't a number. And unfortunately, Mother and Daddy talked to a cousin of my mother's who was head of the physics department at Emory University in Atlanta. And he said, oh, well, if he's going to transfer, you know, as a sophomore, he really ought to go ahead and do it and get in now.
Hmm.
That was in July, and I never expected to be accepted. Unfortunately, I was, so I ended up at Emory University. I never liked Emory, I never liked Atlanta.
Mm.
But my sister and her husband, he got out of the Navy and flew for Eastern, but they were based in Atlanta. So I basically had a sort of a home away from home there, although I always lived on the campus.
Okay.
I was a history major, mainly because it was very easy. I didn't have to study. I could read the text, you know, the night before, or a couple of days before the final, and pass, and that's
right.
What I did.
Right.
I regret that now in many ways.
Right.
I spent much too much time playing bridge.
Okay.
But this was about the time that Vietnam, that was the early 60s, that Vietnam was becoming what it became. And although Daddy retired when I was about five, I was very proud of the fact that my father was career Army. He retired as a bird colonel. Friends that used to come visit and that they used to go visit were quite honestly, most of them were West Point graduates. Daddy was not. But I grew up with I don't know what to call it. I mean, it was just, the military was something you did. Mm-hmm. Even if you didn't make a career of it, you owed something to this country. Now that sounds, you know, schmaltzy or whatever, but nevertheless, that's what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And it was funny, in college, as I say, Vietnam was becoming, and the draft was in force at the time and was a big consideration.
Right.
And I had many friends who strictly stayed in school even after they graduated, or they would change their major to extend the time so that they didn't have to go in the military. Mm-hmm. And they found out quite early that that was something I didn't believe in, and you didn't talk to me about that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this was something you did. And at that time, there was no question, at the beginning of the war anyway, as to whether or not it was right for us to be there. If this was a war we should fight, why were we there? That type of thing. That never occurred to me, to a lot of people, to be honest with you. Not to the extent that the protesting and all of that took place much later.
Right.
But nevertheless, because you were in the generation that was beginning to be drafted, for us it was a concern and a topic that we talked about quite mm-hmm. often.
Okay.
But there was never any question to me about the fact that I would go in the military. It was simply which branch that I want to go in, you know, and that type of thing. That was my attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I decided I didn't like to sleep out in the wilderness like I did with the Boy Scouts. And
right.
I decided I'd much rather be in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
So I joined the Navy. I actually raised my hand and said I do in July of 1962. But I didn't report to OCS or start active duty until January the 11th of 1963.
Okay.
And I went to OCS at Newport, the basic officer training. I didn't like OCS. I won't say I liked it, but you know, it was 4 months I had to go through in order to be an officer.
Right.
And I make no bones about the fact that I'd much rather be an officer than an enlisted man. And so I went to OCS. When I graduated from OCS, or when I was commissioned, it was May 22nd of 1963. My first duty station was air controller training at Glencoe Naval Air Station, which is right outside of Brunswick, Georgia. I was back home, to be honest with you. Home was 90 miles away. I went home every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through the training, and that was fine. It was air controller training, and what we were taught to do was to take a plane that was in the air. You had buggies coming in, and you had to maneuver your plane to get behind the bogey coming in so that the pilot could shoot him down.
Mm, okay.
And like all training, or particularly training in the, that anything that dealt with flight or the air, weather has a lot to say about when you do what and how long it takes and that type of thing.
Right.
So I guess we basically did get out of that one fairly on time. We may have been a bit late, but it was a total of 5 months training.
Okay.
I went there in May, got out in late October, early November. and went to the USS Pocono, which was an amphibious command ship based in Norfolk, Virginia. It was an old Liberty hull, the round bottoms, and while we carried Comte Blanc, Commander of Amphibious Forces Atlantic, who at that time was John S. McCain, the present senator's father.
Right.
And the son of the World War II admiral.
Mm-hmm.
But because McCain, and this was common scuttlebutt in the Navy, he wanted to outrank his father, literally. And he made no bones about it. And he went from chief of naval CINFO, naval information, which is basically publicity, that type of thing for the Navy,
right,
which was normally a dead-end place. That was what you did before you retired. But McCain was the rare exception, and he managed to go back to the fleet as Commander Amphibious Forces Atlantic. But he was, since he basically was very ambitious, the telephone lines, and this is the way the captain of the ship put it when he retired, actually, and left the ship. He said it was the first time he had ever realized that a telephone line could be stronger than the cable by which you anchored, because McCain wanted to go back and forth to Washington. And in Norfolk, you're right there, it's no problem, and he did quite often.
Right.
But we very seldom left port. We basically went out one weekend every 2 months so that the enlisted personnel could draw their sea pay.
Ah, right.
The rest of the time, we stayed in port, in Norfolk. That was not particularly pleasant. In many ways, it was boring. And since I was a bachelor at that time, I don't know how it is now, but I could live off base if I wanted to, but I had to fund the whole, you know, expense myself.
Right.
Only when you were married did you draw a quarter's allowance and those types of things. So I was basically stuck aboard ship. There's not much to do aboard ship, and Norfolk, even at that time, was basically unfriendly to Navy personnel. The old cliche, I'm not sure I ever really saw a sign that said, you know, Navy personnel or seamen and dogs keep off the grass. But really, that was the attitude of the civilians in Norfolk. We really were not, I didn't think, of course, I'm not sure I really had a, not living, you know, off the ship, had an unbiased view of that. Mm-hmm. But I was never really very happy in Norfolk, okay. bored a lot or whatever.
Right.
So I stayed there through, I reported in November, and I stayed there about a year. And then I applied for a friend of mine, a board ship, and I decided we wanted to go to flight school. So we applied, and he finally chickened out at the last minute. I didn't. And we went, I was sent to Pensacola for pre-flight.
Okay.
As far as the shipboard service was concerned, we did do one operation right before I left, as a matter of fact, where we did a joint exercise with the Spanish Navy. And it was the largest amphibious operation since World War II.
Uh-huh.
And it was McCain's baby, of course. And so I did get a taste of what sea life might be like. We did, you know, fueling at sea, refueling, that type of thing. We went sailed in close formation, blackout at night, you know. So I at least got a little taste of it. Went to Pensacola.
Well, if I could ask, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but could you talk a little bit, I guess, about what were your actual duties there?
Oh,
what did you do?
Okay, I was OI Division Officer, which is basically Combat Information Center, CIC. The kids that ran the radars and I suppose could repair them or whatever, but they were the eyes of the ship at sea. You know, it was always dark in there and lit only by the radar reflections and that type of thing.
Right.
But the radar and the sonar were basically what I was dealing with. I also was the tactical publications officer for the ship, where I found out, and maybe this is true of all bureaucracy, first time I ran into it, however, once something is classified, you're stuck with it forever. Because nobody will take responsibility for declassifying it or getting rid of it.
Right.
I will say that then that was sort of amusing because there was one manual that we could find that had that the Spanish Navy had access to for communications. Spain was not a member of NATO, and this was years after World War II, and NATO had been, you know, there for a long time,
right.
And most of your communications manuals and that type of thing, I suppose also with the advancement of technology or whatever, were out of date. But we finally got one, and we found one other for the Admiral staff. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, I suppose. We did, as I say, go out every now and then. We did a couple of exercises, again, 4 or 5 days, with Marines from, what's the base in North Carolina?
Camp Lejeune?
Yes, Lejeune. Okay. But we would go out and do exercises there, amphibious type, whatever. But again, we were the command ship, so we didn't really carry very many. We were mostly staff. The Marines we carried were not the ones that landed, you know, on the beaches and that type of thing. That's about it as far as Norfolk was concerned. Even though Vietnam was becoming, as I say, more and more prominent, I don't even remember when the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was, but nevertheless, Vietnam was the war. And although we, being based on the Atlantic coast and being on a command ship, and particularly with John S. McCain, that was a peripheral thing to us at that time. But that's about it. I of course stood watches on the quarter deck. I did manage to qualify for officer of the officer of the day, anyway, whatever it's called now, that let you stand watches and run the ship, basically, while you were underway.
Okay.
But there again, that was just a lucky fluke. One of the guys that I used to stand Vern Nobles under, watch under, taught me as you were underway that, you know, the officer never stands and looks at the compass all the time. You have to keep watch your distance from the different ships, you know, and that type of thing. And the easiest way to keep your roughly ship headed in the right direction is to find you a star right ahead of you, something that you could look away from and still find when you went back. And I caught a helmsman who, I won't say he went to sleep, but all at once that star was whirling off to the left, you know, and this was the exercise going to Europe with the Spanish Navy. And we were close quarters, and you did not vary because you would run into the ship next door,
sure.
And I screamed at him.
Right.
And I was the first one that actually caught it, but it was only because I happened to be looking at that little star at the moment. I never understood, I'm not mechanical, I never understood the engineering aspect. I was always terrified of having the con, because you don't stop a ship the way you stop a car. You don't have brakes that work quite that way.
Right.
And I was never comfortable underway on the quarterdeck or any of those things. As I say, it was strictly a fluke that I qualified as officer of the deck underway. I was also a reserve, by the way.
Okay.
I was not regular Navy. Anyway, that was about it for Norfolk.
Okay.
The training command for pilots and naval flight officers, which is what I ended up as, I spent more time waiting than I did actually either going to school or getting hands-on training flying. Mm-hmm. And that, again, was because of the weather and was just the way things were. And I presume it's still the way today. I did go through pre-flight, and then I started flight training, pilot training, at NAS Softley, which is right outside of Norfolk, Virginia Beach, I think it is. And I washed out of flight school. Basically, I requested it, but nevertheless, I don't know how much this had to do with it or what the underlying cause was, but I was afraid to fly. I was not afraid to fly if somebody else was flying, but mm-hmm. for me to actually fly the airplane terrified me. Mm. And even though I got all the way through, and at the end of your pre-flight or your beginning flying, you have to solo in essence. What you do is you go out to one of the little outlying airfields, and your instructor lets you land. He hops out, and you have to make three or four touch and goes.
Right.
And I did that, but. To be honest with you, I was so tense that I didn't know whether I would be able to use my legs. I was just paralyzed when he got out. And sort of a combination of me and my instructor decided flying was not for me. But, as I say, I didn't mind flying. I loved flying. And he used to take me up at night when he would go up sometimes just to play around and do acrobatics and that type of thing. He'd take me with him, and I loved it.
Right.
But not to be the pilot. Mm-hmm. So they let me switch to flight officer school, Navy navigator, basically. Or at least that's what I ended up with, was aerial navigation.
Okay.
That was a very tiny part of being a flight officer. Most of them ended up in the back seat of a jet, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
But I went from there to Corpus Christi. And that was the aerial navigation. I did spend 16 weeks, I think it was, back at Pensacola going through basic naval flight officer school. I did quite well, as a matter of fact. but you were sent from there to whatever basic duty would be your first assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew when I left Pensacola that I was going to Corpus Christi for celestial navigation, and from there I would go to a transport squadron. Not combat in the main sense of the word.
Right.
And again, it took forever at Corpus, and you spent more time in the officers club or whatever, reading, playing around. If it was summertime, go to the beach, then you did actual flying because the weather determined that, and inevitably bad weather had caused classes to back up. And so you virtually had a long waiting period before you would actually begin flying. And then when you did fly, that could be extended the period of time flying if you had bad weather, you know, and weren't able to fly at the time.
Okay.
So I went from there to Naval Air Transport Squadron, VR-3,
mm-hmm.
in New Jersey. We were based at McGuire Air Force Base. And this was sort of a funny situation. There were only two Navy Air Transport Squadrons. And the reason was the Air Force had looked around and realized that SAC, their main reason for existence, the thing that made them so important and powerful as far as the military was concerned, you had submarines that could do the same thing. They could stay out on location much longer mm-hmm. than a plane flying around in the air could.
Right.
So SAC was becoming less important. And that scared the Air Force. So the upshot of it was that the Air Force was going to take over all transport flying for the military, period.
Hmm.
So whereas we had a lot of Naval Air Transport Squadrons at the time I was there, there were only two of us left, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast.
Okay.
One on the West Coast was based at Moffett Field. We were at McGuire Air Force Base, and basically, we were assigned to the Air Force. The only connection we had with the Navy was the fact that they paid our basic salary, and we wore Navy uniforms and flight suits versus the Air Force. That was the only way you could tell us apart. The planes we flew were Air Force. Because of the situation, we really had two basic types of flying there.
Okay.
There was what they call the Châtellerault stage, which you would go to Europe and spend 30 days based in France and then fly cargo all over Europe.
Or if
you weren't on the Châtellerault stage, you were going from McGuire. Basically, the circuit was, you left McGuire, you went someplace in the States, picked up the cargo you were going to take, and went to Travis Air Force Base.
Okay.
You crew rested, you got off, you were only able to fly for basically 8 hours of flight time, but your pre-flight and all of that had to be considered too, so it was more than 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, you did what you call burned out. And you would have to go back into crew rest. But theoretically, the way it should have worked, if everything was a perfect world, you got off and spent the crew rest time at Travis. The airplane went on to Hawaii. Uh-huh. You caught one coming in after you had crew rested. The crew got off, you got on, and you went to Hawaii.
Mm.
But there again, you crew rested there, and then you picked up the plane that was coming in behind you. And the normal circuit was McGuire to Travis to Hawaii to Wake Island, although it was not a destination. We always stopped in Guam one way or the other.
Okay.
You could buy your gallon of duty-free booze. I'm serious.
Right, yeah.
But you didn't crew rest or anything there. You went from there on to the Philippines at Cebu. It was actually Mactan Air Base, but that was an island, the main island that you were connected with, although you had to take a God, I've forgotten what they call it, Banca, over to Cebu. And sometimes, depending upon whether or not the crew rest trailers on Mactan were available or not, you might end up in Cebu City, which we did several times. Mm-hmm. But from there, you caught a plane that was coming in, you went into Vietnam, dropped your cargo, picked up anything, if there was anything to go, and went from there up to Japan, Tachikawa. From Tachikawa, you crew rested there, you caught one, a plane coming in, and you went back to Alaska. And from Alaska, you overflew Canada and ended up back at McGuire Air Force Base. And the whole thing took usually about 9 to 10 days. And we flew under, or we didn't fly under Air Force regulations. The normal Navy attitude would have been, you get home, you, you know, spend the night, get up, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and go to work the next morning. Well, that's not the way the Air Force operated.
Okay.
The joke used to be that the Air Force operated, they would decide to build an air base. The Air Force would, or the Navy would go in and build the runways and all the hangars, and then start in the Officers Club and run out of money. And Congress or Washington would say, oh, well, sorry about that, but you've got the runways, you've got the facilities, you can fly, so it's done. The Air Force goes in, and they build the Officers Club, and they build the Officers Quarters and the Enlisted Quarters, and then they start on the runways and the hangars and that type of thing, and they get halfway through, and they run out of money. And Congress says, oh, well, you can't operate because you don't have runways, so here's some more money. But basically, that was sort of the attitude that we, at least in the Navy, considered ourselves in relation to the Air Force.
Right.
But the Air Force regulations at that time were, for a crew that went out, for every 3 days you were gone, you had a day off when you got back. Mm. That did not count, however, or they did count in there. No, the Air Force did not count the weekends. So if you were gone 10 days, you may or may not have covered a weekend. Mm. Our captain of our squadron decided that we would go the Navy one better. So for every 3 days we were gone, we got a day, and we got to count the weekends. So we got those two extra days to count. And sometimes if you left on a Friday, you were gone one weekend and you didn't get back before the next weekend was over. So we would get those 4 days counted, and we got extra time. But it was not at all unusual to come back and have 5 days off, depending upon how long, you know, because if you were crew resting and the plane coming in for some reason was late, you could burn out and have to go back into crew rest. So the crew right behind you would take it and you would take their place and catch one. But it could take longer than your normal 10, 11 days to make that circuit to Vietnam and back. Mm. Right. And I've gotten back on a Friday, had the weekend all the next week and the next weekend where I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to, get dressed, go to the squadron, sit around or do anything like that. Mm-hmm. But that was, again, simply our captain's way of making us a little different from the Air Force.
Right.
It was funny, or I won't say it was funny, I'm sure the things we carried were important, but I used to say that we carried everything from dirt to dogs, because quite literally we did fly a plane of dirt, but it was diatomaceous earth used in filtering systems, so you know it wasn't really dirt.
Right.
And we did carry some military dogs one time. The whole plane was filled with the dogs and their handlers. Knowing my hearing now and how keen the dogs were, I've often wondered if they got the, you know, were subject to the deafness the way, because the joke in the squadron used to be, and I don't consider it a joke anymore, believe me, you know, when it came time to retire, instead of a gold watch, they handed you a hearing aid, saluted, and off you went. And that was not really quite so far-fetched. Many of the officers that I've known that you get in the officers' club, where there's or the crew rest situations where there would be a bar or something like that, and because of the noise, they had very big problems communicating with you, and it was not at all unusual to see, you know, somebody sitting there with his hand cut behind his ear so that he could understand what you were saying. I've often wondered, since there's no way to prove it, I still believe that's what caused my hearing loss. But it's not the type of thing that happens immediately. It's something that takes place over time. And I know when kids first started carrying boom boxes, you know, on their shoulder,
right?
And hell, they were had it up so high that the whole world could hear. A lot of your articles about that would say they're going to regret that, you know, years from now.
Right.
But there's no way to prove it. So I have no military disability or anything like that.
Right.
But I'm still convinced that that's what is the root cause of my hearing loss, which started in my early 50s.
Mm. Right.
But anyway, I did get two trips to Europe, but only, well, one of them was only overnight, spent the night in Frankfurt. But I did go one time, and we were not supposed to know what we were carrying, because what we were carrying was not supposed to be. But we carried, and we flew with an augmented crew, which meant we could fly around the clock, or at least 18 hours. We had two navigators, we had four pilots and two engineers, that type of thing. You weren't caught with that 8-hour flight time and no, nothing else.
Right.
But we took radar equipment to Iran. God, Mashhad was the place right that we delivered it,
okay.
Which was just south of the Soviet border. But we weren't supposed to be doing that, so we were never told what we were doing as carrying, but that's what we did. However, we burned out a starter on an engine as we landed in Tehran, but we had to get a final flight plan, up to Mashhad and back. The pilot and the co-pilot went in, and one of the other navigators, I didn't go, went in to file the flight plan for Mashhad, and one of the co-pilot that was left decided he would save everybody a little time and had the plane right ready to go when they got back. So we were refueled and all that, and he burned, so I don't say it was his fault, but nevertheless, he was the one who burned the starter out. But we did manage to get it started. And we went on up, and Mashhad dropped it off, never shut the plane down, turned right around and came back to Tehran. Mm. And there we did shut it down, and they couldn't start it again.
Mm-hmm.
They had, again, this. Sometimes you think, well, you know, your $100 toilet seat and that type of thing.
Right.
These things actually happen.
Right.
We couldn't get that engine started. Well, by the way, I never did say we flew
C-130s. C-130s, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But we did, every morning we would get up. Now, the first night we spent it in some don't believe me. We were on the fifth floor, I think it was, and there was no water above the third. No air conditioning. But that was only the first night.
Right.
And we were, in order to get into the engine or fix the starter or whatever, it took a special set of wrenches. There was not one in Europe at the time. So they had to fly one from the U.S. over. Well, somebody in Italy decided that was not priority cargo, so they offloaded it.
Yeah.
We had to, that just extended the time.
Right.
And finally, they sent also, when it finally came, they sent a technician from, or a mechanic from Greece. And they did actually get the starter changed, but we spent a week. Every morning we'd check out at the Royal Tehran Hilton, go down and sit under the shadow of the wing, be out of the sun. Then we would go back at 4 o'clock, check back into the Hilton, and spend the night.
Right.
We did that for one full week.
Yeah.
But we did get the starter changed and got us started. But as we were coming back, the engine caught fire landing in Greece to let the mechanic off. And our commanding, the plane commander, he was actually the executive officer of our squadron, walked in and told them he wanted the engine changed. He did not want it fixed, he wanted it changed, and when they had it changed, they could call us and we would come pick up the airplane. So we spent a week, another week in Greece,
right.
In Athens,
right.
Which was actually pretty nice, but it was funny, it went over the end of a month, and I guess at that time you didn't necessarily have your automatic banking. You picked up your paycheck. And those of us who were bachelors on the crew had no paycheck to pick up, and credit cards were not as frequent or common as they are today. We had one guy, one Lieutenant J.G., who had an American Express card, and there was the bazaar in Tehran, you got to go shop or, you know, that type of thing. We couldn't do anything as far as spending money, most of us, because our paycheck was sitting in the squadron waiting for us to pick it up. It wasn't in the bank. We couldn't write a check. Well, you know, we were out of money.
Right.
But he took everything that anybody wanted on his American Express card.
All right.
We all paid him when we got back.
Yeah.
That type of experience, again, I hate to say it, but it wasn't uncommon. I guess as far as the flying goes, that was about it. The Air Force did convince the military, the government, that we shouldn't have any Navy squadrons at all. So they closed the squadron at Moffett, and they closed the one that we were flying with, and the Air Force took over all military transport, although the Army still had theirs. We didn't. And I was sent from there to the Naval Academy.
Okay.
I've forgotten the captain's name who had become commandant of Annapolis, but he decided that Annapolis is different from your other service academies. In both West Point and Colorado Springs, they take military, send them out to get their PhDs, but they're kept in uniform and then send them back in their duty station, basically, I think, for life. Becomes, as you know, an instructor at the whichever academy they're there. The Naval Academy is different. I don't know what the ratio is now, but at the time I was there, it was about 50% civilian versus military. But that again is sort of skewed because most of your military were not sent into your academic departments, at least as far as things like history or that type of thing. If they were instructors, they were sent to, or they were assigned to departments like weapons or, you know, whatever. But it was a technical side of it. And the most of the academic personnel were actually civilians. And a lot of this was a result of, and don't get me wrong, the people I worked with anyway, and I was in the English, history, and government department, EH&G. And the reason I said the commas was, at some point while I was there, this was while I was there, a group of congressmen came over from Washington to tour the academy. And one of them wanted to know, what was all this emphasis on English history for? Wasn't American history good enough? But anyway, the captain who was commandant of the Naval Academy decided that he was going to bring the academy up to academic standards.
Okay.
So the only military people who were sent there to teach, other than being a company officer or something like that, and a lot of those were Marines, would be people who were academically prepared. And one thing I did, I never wrote the thesis, so I didn't get a master's in history, but I did do the coursework for it, and did it twice, as a matter of fact. I did it again after I got out. But anyway, we were sent to, I ended up in the English History and Government Department. I was lucky. I could just as easily have ended up knowing the way the military, you know, you're a warm body and you're sent and you will do whatever you're sent to do. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether you're qualified, you'll get it on the job or whatever.
Right.
I could have been sent to weapons or math or whatever, engineering, and which would have been terrible because I'm not a mechanical person. But anyway, I spent 2 years then teaching midshipmen. I taught one semester I would teach English, beginning, just basic courses, mainly English literature is starting, and it was mostly English. We did get the last half of it into American, but you started with the Romantic poets. Or the rest of the time I spent with history.
Okay.
And that basically, the way we taught it, the way the course was set up, was basically 1603, the death of Elizabeth, you know, world history, just a survey course.
Right.
Up to the present. And you never got to the present. There was never enough time.
Mm-hmm.
I did also, while I was there, end up working with the debate team. Which, if you've never been exposed to collegiate debate, it was a shock to see people stand up and talk for 10 to 15 minutes, whatever the time of your speeches, and then your rebuttals. Never pausing, they spoke in paragraphs, they didn't speak in sentences. It was amazing what those kids could do.
Right.
We had never had a decent debate team at the Naval Academy, but the guy that was doing it when I was there, it ended up, I moved in with Phil and we shared a house in the last year I was there. They sold the apartment complex I was in to the city of Annapolis for public housing.
Yeah.
And Annapolis could not afford or absorb 400 families dumped out on the local economy. And the guy that had been rooming with Phil, sharing the house with him, was a Marine who was being reassigned to Vietnam. So Phil said, Eddie's leaving, you need a place, would you like to move in? And I did. But I had known Phil because I was working with him in debate prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm playing around on the internet about a year ago, as a matter of fact. I Googled Phil Morgan to see where he was or if he was still around. He was about 5 years older than I was, and he had died. But although at the time I left, he was threatening to quit debate. You had to, when you were assigned academically, you were expected to have some extracurricular activity that you participated in. It could be a soccer coach or, you know, whatever. I ended up with the debate team. And Phil, the same thing was true of the civilians. They were soccer coaches part-time, too. Phil was threatening to quit debate. It could be very time consuming, and we ended up with what became my team the year after I left there. Actually, 2 years after I left there, ended up as the runner up in the National Collegiate Debate. This was not parliamentary debate. This was God, what's the other term for it? Anyway. He evidently made the Navy a powerhouse in debate. And you got to know certain coaches. The schools were known for the debate coach. And there were certain schools that were known as debate powers, Northwestern being the main one. Northwestern, Dartmouth, Georgetown, those were some of the finest coaches, and they produced the finest teams. But I convinced Phil that if he wanted to do that, he couldn't do what he had normally been doing and what was the normal course through the academy as far as debate was concerned. He had to take a very junior team and give them the experience at the national level, really. The very top-flight tournaments, if he wanted a really top-notch team. And we had two young men, one of them ended up in the Marines, and he was the football type. And it hurt to hear him when you first started debating. He had never debated before. One of them was a very good high school debater. But he taught himself to debate. He bought himself a tape recorder, and he would find an empty room and do his, and by the time they got to be seniors, first class, they were as fine as any team in this country. They had been my team that last year I was there, and Phil took them, and he, even while I was there, he gave us good tournaments. We didn't go to the rinky-dink ones, but he took them then as his team. And the Naval Academy tournament was a good tournament. It was a well-respected tournament, but in reading his obituary, he stayed with debate, and he evidently became a national power, and they renamed the Navy debate tournament as the Philip Warkin Memorial Debate Tournament. But that was an experience. It was also, and I used to do this because I was still in the mode of, you know, hey, this is the military. And I would frankly tell them, you know, hey, if you don't want to, if you don't like the Navy, or when you go out on your summer cruises and you come back and you're convinced, tell me, I will help you get out. Or for that matter, if your wife doesn't like it when you get out and you get married, and you want to make a career of it, because let's face it, they were Academy graduates, they were ring knockers, they could, you know, they had a path if they wanted it.
Right.
Then don't mess around, get out. If your wife's not happy, you're not going to be happy.
Right.
But I used to take a day every now and then, because really the Naval Academy was not, except for the fact that you wore the uniforms and that type of thing, and your coursework might be different, it still wasn't the fleet. It wasn't out the way a normal naval officer would live, or what you would do aboard ship, or anything like that. And every now and then, we were encouraged to do this too, those of us who were military.
Mm-hmm.
Take half your period, take the period. Just talk to them. Let them ask anything they want about what Navy life for an officer, a junior officer anyway, is really like.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do that. And again, the reason I got out of the Navy, well, there are several reasons. Being gay didn't help. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to the academy, I was a full-blown alcoholic. And if I'd stayed in, if one hadn't gotten me, the other would. Mm-hmm. There was no don't ask, don't tell at that time. And there was no, and they did begin to do this fairly soon after I got out. Because a lot of the problems that people came back from Vietnam with and related to drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get treatment, but at the time I was in, forget it, I would have been kicked out as a drunk.
Right.
But that's neither here nor there. Obviously, if you've seen me around here, I'm not an alcoholic. Well, I'm not a practicing alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. I will always be an alcoholic. And by God, if you want any help, don't waste your time. Go straight to an AA meeting. And it was years before anybody told me that.
Mm.
But anyway, I've been sober for 25 years.
Mm.
And the 5 years before that, I was just periodic. But the 15 before that, I was drunk the whole time. There were a couple of times I did go into treatment and try to dry out, and it might last maybe a week or a month. And I won't blame that on the Navy, although I will say that the availability of alcohol made it quite easy if you were so inclined to do nothing but drink or to the extent that you did become physically addicted to alcohol. But anyway, that again is neither here nor there. But the reason I got out was, God, if anybody knew the benefits of military retirement, hell, my father was a retired colonel. I did.
Right. Sure.
Every time I went home, if they were headed, because you know he had a yearly physical to go take and all of that. And he did a couple of times. He had towards the end of his life, he developed malignant tumors in his bladder. And once a year, he'd go over to Fort Gordon. They'd cut him open, scrape him out, and send him home.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually made money. He had a little insurance policy that paid him,
right.
Per diem basically. And so I knew the advantages of military retirement, but as I say, being both an alcoholic and gay, mm-hmm. one of those would have gotten me.
Mm-hmm.
But the real incident that caused it was I went to Washington and went to the Pentagon and talked to the Navy and said I wanted my third year at Annapolis. There were four or five officers from my squadron that had gone to the academy at the same time I did, and they were academy graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a third year.
Right.
I wanted a third year. I was not an academy graduate, and I was told you will go to the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like hell I will, look at my release date and write my orders. So I got out basically for the alcohol and being gay were the two main reasons internally,
mm-hmm.
but the actual cause of it was that interview, and I just said, well, hell, I'll get out. And I'm very glad I did, because I really would have screwed up at some point, and it wouldn't have been very long, and instead of, well, I would have been more of a disgrace and a black sheep to my family than I actually was. But the things that I have thought about later. I still, by the way, believe that everybody owes this country a debt. As the cliche goes, freedom is not free. Right. It has to be bought and paid for, and we're the people who do it. Mm-hmm. And I have no tolerance for anybody who doesn't feel that way. And I understand, because I have a niece, for example, who has children. My uncle in my little hometown, the one who's still alive and still left, his children obviously don't feel that way. But that's the way I felt. Mm-hmm. And I've thought particularly lately with Iraq and Afghanistan, the difference between the military then and the military now, and the war then and the wars we have now, and what the attitude is and why the attitude is there or whatever. And literally, say what you will, I'm firmly convinced that the government and the military completely censor everything now. But for Vietnam, much more so than any other war, and because of television, right, you had the war in your living room every evening and twice on Sundays.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it wasn't touched up, it wasn't censored. You know, you saw the wounded being put on stretchers and landing in the, you know, when the caskets would come home. And the, obviously, the, and of course, there are lots of other things that go to make that up. But the response or the attitude of the general public about war, of the whatever war you are in at the moment, I'm not sure we'll ever have another World War II, you know, where it was a simpler world and you truly were fighting for the right as opposed to the wrong, you know, that type of thing. And like it or not, and this was particularly, hell, we used to say it, the attitude, at least of the people that I was served with and in the places I served, the attitude was, it's the only war we've got, don't knock it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that particularly, the Naval Academy, because they were there for career, you know,
right,
and they needed a war for their record, so that they could be promoted and, you know, whatever. And I never, and I guess this again was because of my father, I had a great deal of trouble readjusting to civilian life. Now that was exacerbated by being gay and being an alcoholic. But I never understood, yeah, see my ponytail? I never understood at that time long hair. I didn't think very much of people who went to Canada.
Right.
I didn't understand the student uprisings or demonstrations, you know, or that type of thing. And I really had a great deal of problems dealing with the world and whatever. And basically the alcohol really would exacerbated it. Before I sobered up, I ended up even working for the Drug Enforcement Administration and being busted for drugs because I stole them. Nursing homes sent them to us to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite easy for me to smuggle them out. And being an alcoholic, I was into trying anything and everything, you know. Again, that seeing a psychiatrist, which I had done, was a shameful mark and was reason for you to be suspect and not to be promoted or retained in civil service, that type of thing. But it was all mixed up. I'm not blaming anything or anybody. It was just the way it was. I didn't understand my contemporaries, primarily the people I was faced with or thrown with when I got out of the military. I've grown older and wiser. There's a saying in AA that you start your growth and development the day you take your first drink. And I think that was quite true in my case. You live for the bottle, so you don't learn to live, you know. I didn't know what anybody did at night if you didn't get drunk. What did you do? The idea of watching TV or reading a book or going bowling or dancing or whatever, that was just the world. I went straight out of college into the military, right. And everything combined, I just didn't know how the real world lived, and it wasn't until I sobered up that I began to live. And think like I think a normal human being does, but I no longer think that it's the only war we've got. Don't knock it. Sorry, I don't think we should have been in Vietnam ever. If I have any feelings toward somebody who went to Canada, it's more a feeling of admiration and for their courage and whatever it took to do that. I, in many ways, don't like the world today, don't get me wrong, but I'm a liberal in everything, in my politics. Everything else, I'm very conservative, I don't dress outlandishly. It took me forever to get up nerve enough to grow a ponytail, but damn it, out here, the wind blows and my hair never has had any body. Right. And I look like a banshee, you know, without it. So, I'm glad and I'm proud of the fact that I did serve. I was very moved when the wall, the touring wall, came to Tech. I've never visited the wall in Washington. I hadn't been to Washington, to be honest with you, but I intend to do that before I die. We were, and this again is part of the reason I think that I feel I'm a little bitter at the way the military and the people were treated when we came back, or when you got out or whatever.
Right.
I'm sorry, it's a very admirable thing to do. Unfortunately, I also don't feel we should be in Iraq. I never thought we should have. I never thought we should be in Afghanistan. Sorry about that, you know. And hey, 9/11, well, hey, I'm sorry, but one of these days I fully expect some terrorist to get an atom bomb and to use the damn thing. But that's life. Life happens, and like it or not, you know, in spite of all you can do. But I don't believe in whatever was Sarah Palin didn't know about, the Bush Doctrine. We wouldn't stand for anybody coming into our country.
Right.
Why should we have the right to go into theirs? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I had, in my old age, become very opinionated about certain things. I've never even discussed them. I don't have an occasion to. Mm-hmm. But I do feel very strongly about certain things. And as I say, one of the things that I have always felt and still do is the freedom ain't free. You pay for it. you do your part. And if it's not military, by God, then have a, you know, some way, find some way to serve this country. Mm-hmm. I would be all in favor of a required obligation for people in the civilian world that's equal to the military, you know, something. I'm very proud of the fact that I did serve and didn't screw up in the military. I have a great admiration for people who do go into the military and who are part of the military. I don't know. I just have very strong feelings about it. I do think, by the way, that the Vietnam Archive is, it ought to be one of Texas Tech's crowning glories. I've always felt that the attitude behind it, and this again is from Dr. Reasoner, is you need some place where you can go and study it dispassionately. And like it or not, Vietnam, I think, came the closest to being a civil war, which was my major as an undergraduate. I was one of the area in graduate school. In the divisions that it caused in this country and that type of thing. I never will be anything but a little bit bitter at the way we were treated, you know, and that type of thing.
Right.
But I can live with it. Hey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't think I have anything else to say.
Well, I have a few questions, okay. If you don't. Not too much, but just a few more. when you were talking earlier about making the circuit to Vietnam, all the way to Vietnam and coming back, could you talk just a little bit more about that? Like, how much time would you guys spend in Vietnam when you would make one of those trips?
We didn't.
Okay.
That was the point. That's why I told you in the questionnaire I filled out, right. We were never allowed to stay in Vietnam.
Okay.
You left the Philippines, you took whatever you were taking, you went into Vietnam, you dropped the cargo, you picked up something, and you went to Tachikawa in Japan.
Okay.
The main places we landed, or the only three that I remember, there was once we landed on something we shouldn't have, and considering the weight of the airplane and the temperature and the humidity and that type of thing, we couldn't take off until after dark. So we did stay there that time, about 6 hours.
Okay.
But normally we either went to Tansanook, Da Nang, or Cameron Bay.
Okay, right.
And you flew in, you dropped your cargo, you picked up whatever there was, if there was anything. A lot of times there wasn't. And you took off and you headed straight for Japan.
Mm.
I won't say that I was never shot at. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were a couple of night flights that we took in that you could see the flash of gunfire. But I can't say that it was aimed at us. And so far as I know, an airplane that I was on was never hit or anything like that.
Right. Okay. All right. So generally just dropping off maybe on the ground a few hours or so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Just as long as it took to drop it. We didn't refuel or anything there.
Sure.
Just okay. Drop the cargo. If there was any, load it and take off.
Okay.
That basically was it. And as I say, the rest of the circuit,
mm-hmm.
you, there were a couple of times, well, there was at one point where instead of going to Hawaii, they were redoing the runway, and we ended up going to Midway. It's just an interesting little place.
Oh, man.
And the goody birds really do walk around. You know, you have to kick them out of the way at times. They cannot land. They are funny. But I, I, I like the fact that I've been to some places that nobody will ever go to.
Sure.
Midway being one of them.
Right.
Wake Island being another one. And Wake Island is not one island, it's three. There's a little island in south of Japan called, it was on the tip of my tongue, Marcus. There was a Loran station there that we ran, and we at one point volunteered to take a load of cargo to Marcus Island and drop it off and come back to Japan. Because of weather, at one point we did spend the night on Okinawa. As I say, Guam. Stop for your gallon of booze. The flip side of that is, and I found this true both of the shipboard life and of flying, the way to see the world is not through a porthole or through a windshield of an airplane.
Mm.
You basically are on duty. When you stop to crew rest, it's scheduled and timed for crew rest, and there's not time to go out and visit, you know, this attraction or whatever. And a couple of times we would get, you know, stranded in Hawaii. What the hell, you know? Yeah, and we did. We'd either go to the pool or hit Waikiki.
Mm-hmm.
But you only had the 8 hours. There was never any time to know what the world was about, to absorb the cultures of other countries, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
And that, again, may have been unique to the type of service that I did while I was in. Leaving the ship, there was a guy on the ship that was leaving at the same time I was, who got sent to the Orkney Islands, north of Scotland. That would have been a totally different, you know, experience. And he got to stay there for 2 years. And I talked to him once or twice later.
Right.
But that's not the experience I had. Mine was in and out.
Right. Okay. All right. One last question I had for you. I know you were talking a little earlier about how before early on you had the view of Vietnam that, you know, this is probably the right thing, we should probably be there. And later you mentioned that your view had changed completely. You know, talking about your change in your view on Vietnam.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more, I guess, about what brought about that change in your mind about was there anything in particular that made you change your view?
As I say, I think it was primarily sobering up, number mm-hmm. one, and giving some thought to it. But basically, it was growing up. It was becoming a man instead of being a teenager, because literally. And again, I don't mean to stress this, but the world of the alcoholic is so totally wrapped up in alcohol that you don't think about anything else.
Mm.
And I never really thought about it. When I did stop and think about it, it was no one thing. It was simply growing up, maturing, realizing that you know, there are different viewpoints. Things are very seldom ever simply black and white.
Right.
And becoming tolerant of people, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I'm still bitter, and I always will be, at the way the Vietnam vet was treated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't think that was... I think that, to me, that's a stigma and a black mark on this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't care whether you like the war or don't like the war, but the people who do their job And in today's world, and I guess always has been to an extent, you've got to have, you know, some kind of security for your country and that type of thing. Now, that may be used wrong because of the way that our system works, where the civilian, you know, has the final word as to where the military goes and what they do. But nevertheless, the people who do serve in the military, that type of thing, I think are, they deserve admiration and a vote of thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get it.
Yes,
and that pisses me off.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything we haven't covered at this point?
No, nothing that I can think of, except that, as I say, I am very glad, and I'm particularly glad that I happen to be here, but I'm very glad that there is a Vietnam Archive, mm-hmm. and that it does the job it does and has the direction and the values that you have. I really think it's an important thing for this country, and I hope, I'm not sure that they ever do or will, but I would think that Texas Tech would take great pride in it.
Mm.
It's one of the unique things about Texas Tech.
Right.
Everybody has a football team.
Yeah.
Everybody has enough of them have engineering schools or whatever.
Right.
But everybody doesn't have, and I feel the same way about the Southwest Collection, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's something unique.
Right.
And Tech should be very proud of that and very supportive. I also happen to think that it's very important,
mm-hmm.
Both of them, for that matter, the Southwest Collection and the Vietnam Archive.
Yes, sir.
The center.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Well, I will go ahead and bring the interview to a close, but thank you for your time, Albert.
Okay. I enjoyed it.
All right.